Hi there everyone, my name's Darcy. I'm the editor of the Stage Left podcast. I'm just dropping in before this episode begins to let you know that we have a brand new merch line available right now. I'm currently wearing one of our black hoodie designs, which has the Stage Left podcast logo on the front, as well as on the back. But on the back, it's filled with all the guests that have appeared on the Stage Left podcast. I also have one of our notebooks here, which I absolutely love. It keeps me organised with everything in the podcast. It's ring binded and lined as well for my convenience. And I just take it everywhere I go so that I always have my notes with me. It's up to date. And it's a small compact size as well, which helps me save space in my bag. If you want to go check it out, we also have mugs, t-shirts, stickers, more hoodie designs and tote bags as well for you. So head to the-stageleft-podcast.printify.me to check out all of our merch and help support the podcast so that we can keep producing free educational content for you all. Without further ado, let's get on with the episode.
Welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for emerging musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the people behind the success. So go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring members of Radiohead, Queen, Guns N' Roses, Fleetwood Mac, the 1975, Oasis and Kraftwerk. You discuss their writing, recording and performance processes, as well as reflective interviews with musicians and producers who've worked in the studio and on stage with Sabrina Carpenter, Olivia Rodrigo, Beyonce, Elvis and David Bowie. Today we are joined by the voice of Embrace, Danny McNamara, a songwriter responsible for some of the most emotionally powerful records of the last 30 years. And as someone whose band used to cover Liar's Tears and geekily used to turn up to secret gigs up and down the country, this will be an interesting one. They say never meet your heroes. Well, let's see how interviewing them goes. Today we'll be doing a deep dive into the likes of Satellites, That's All Changed Forever and My Weakness Is None of Your Business, exploring the orchestral ambition that made The Good Will Out such a landmark debut, discussing why creative restrictions can sometimes unlock great songwriting, and exploring how these songwriting processes compare on the moving new record Avalanche. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than Danny McNamara of Embrace. Thanks for joining us today, Danny. How's it going?
My pleasure, Chris. What an introduction. Very slick.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. So I listened to the album. So we're recording this the day the album came out, right? So I've only had a chance to listen to it this morning three times. How do you feel on the day of release compared to previous albums that you've done? What emotions are going through you now?
It's been sort of like an extended Christmas Eve for the last 6 months, because we finished the album a while ago now, and sort of then you have to order it and it takes vinyl a while to come through. And so you start the pre-orders and telling the fans about it and then dropping the singles and doing the videos. So it's been quite an intense build-up. But yeah, like you say, it's out today, which is massively exciting. How do I feel about it? I feel really good about the new album. I think it's one of our best. I know bands always say that when they've got a new album out, you kind of have to say it in a way, but I think the fans can tell, like, you know, the band is massively enthusiastic about what we've just done. And we've just been on a short in-store tour supporting the album. So we've played the songs live like half a dozen times in front of various crowds. And alongside the biggest hits, so we've played like six songs from the new album, and then alongside stuff like Oh You Good Good People and Ashes and Gravity and Refugees, and the audiences are loving it, you know, just as much. So it's great. And I just had a chance to look online at what everyone's thinking, and it seems to be an overwhelming outpouring of love for the new album, which is amazing.
And how much energy do you spend on choosing the track listing and the order that the tracks appear? And how different is it today when you see it released to what you imagined when you were piecing the album together?
Well, that's a really good question. It's different depending on the album. On this album, I was really, really instinctive. I've sort of, obviously, like the first album, that's all we had were our instincts. We didn't really know what we were doing. And then sort of along the way, some like crafts and techniques and experience comes in to bear. But then the sort of the epiphany at the end of that is what you learn is that instincts are the main thing to trust. And as I've got more confident, I've trusted my instincts more. So on this album, I didn't, like in, on previous albums, I've had a title like The Goodwill Out I had before we even started the album. And, you know, Love is a Basic Need I had. Quite often, I've usually got a title. On this album, I didn't have a title. And I didn't really have a theme. And I was just sort of writing, just felt like writing. And the theme that emerged is this idea of living in the moment. And I think one of the reasons why we're still writing good music, still making good stuff, when most bands do their best stuff on either their first or their second album and then they get into diminishing returns, it's just that I'm a really slow learner. And I've been having sort of epiphanies. I'm still having them now. Like most people learn about love and about heartbreak and fall in love for the first time and all that stuff in their late teens or early 20s. And then you sort of have life more or less sussed then. And then that's why, you know, there's no exciting music generally comes out of people who are older, because not life's not hitting them in the same way. But I'm just a really slow learner, and I'm still having epiphanies now as a 55-year-old, like I'm still a teenager or a 20-year-old. And so what that means is that this all this stuff, I'm constantly learning. And, you know, this is like a trilogy of albums is like that I've written since I met my wife. Like the first one was Love is a Basic Need. The second one is How to Be a Person Like Other People. And then this album, Avalanche. And what it is with Avalanche is the idea of living in the moment. So, like, you can't not live in the moment when you've got two kids. I've got a 4-year-old and a 7-year-old. And one of the things that they definitely do is they insist that you live in the moment. And in living in the moment, what I then discovered is that there's all these amazing things that have been happening around me that I've not noticed because I've been too busy in my head. I've been too busy trying to create the next Embrace song or, you know, make the next album. I also work on scripts as well. So I've always been in my head. But like 4-year-olds and 7-year-olds, they can't even think like 3 seconds into the future, let alone like 3 months into the future. So you have to live in the moment. And not only that, you have to live in their moment. It's not your moment. It's got to be their moment. Otherwise, they're not interested. So what I discovered was that, like, living in the moment, all these ideas came, all these moments came, and it was like an avalanche. And so when we were deciding on the track listing for the album, it really changed in the last sort of 2 or 3 weeks. Like Richard wasn't happy that we had all the songs that we needed. He just felt like the album was missing something. And there were a couple of tracks that were going to end up on the album that haven't ended up on the album, that got shelved. Because I just said to Rick, I said, like, look, if you're not happy with it, we won't put it out yet. It's got to be right. We've got to be proud of it. It's got to be like, if we die tomorrow, we're happy to put this album out. And so he went away and he wrote Coming Home. And then Mick brought in the keyboard part for Get Out of My Own Way. And then Rick also brought the guitar for Funny. So those 3 tracks all came in the last couple of weeks. So I did have a sort of an idea that a new stop was going to be the opening track. But once those 3 tracks came into the mix, it was then just a case of just listening to all the tracks. We had like 15 tracks and deciding which 10 were going to make the best album.
And from a songwriting perspective, Have you put any kind of restrictions on your writing for this particular record? Or did you have like a sit down meeting with everyone and go, okay, this is what we don't want to do for this record, or this is what we particularly want to achieve? Or was it a case of let's just go what comes out when we get in the room?
I really wanted to only use things that gave me a really strong feeling. And that was it. It didn't matter like how catchy it was or how clever it was or you know, how impressive it was. It just had to give me a feeling.
It's interesting because you once said in an interview years and years ago, I remember seeing in Melody Maker, that you felt the role of a song was to shift the emotional state of the listener. So the moment they put the song on, do you still have that in your back of your mind, or is there something else that you want to achieve?
No, definitely. Definitely. It's just about getting people. Like when you write a song, the only way that I know how to judge whether a song's any good or not is if I'm feeling it, you know. We have in the past, like, released songs that sort of were all bells and whistles and kind of made all the same noises and shapes and sounded big. And those songs, they can sound impressive in the moment and you can kind of fall for it a little bit, but they sort of go by the wayside. Songs that stand the test of time and people keep coming back to, generally, it's because it's made them feel a certain way and they want to get back to that feeling. And I think it's as primal as that, really.
It's interesting when you say about the feeling. So if you take a song like Drawn from Memory or Liar's Tears, you're going to get a certain feeling as a listener or writer from that that's quite different to like Yeah, You or New Adam, New Eve, which is like, let's kind of go for it. So are you chasing any emotional shift, or what is that feeling, given that they might be different feelings depending on the kind of style in which you write the song?
Obviously, like you know, a song like Pure O on the new album is a very, very different feeling to Get Out of My Own Way on the new album, and All You Good Good People is a very different feeling to Fireworks, you know. But they're both really potent versions of the feeling that they are, you know. They're both, I think, really strong sort of. So it's not any particular feeling. I'm not sort of trying to have, otherwise you just have the same feeling all the way through an album, you know. So it's not like a particular one. It's just, and a lot of it is instinctive. You're like, the album needs this. It needs a lift here, or it needs a moment of introspection here, or, you know, it needs to kick ass here. It needs, you know, it's, but you can sort of fake all those things and kind of the feeling, you know, whether it gives you the feeling is the most potent aspect of it. That you can bluff that a little bit if you know what you're doing. You know, you can make a song that has a big chorus like All You Good Good People, or, you know, you can make a song that's about a broken love affair like Fireworks or whatever. But if it's only got a little bit of the feeling, it's just not a good version of that. Do you know what I mean? So it's the amount of the feeling that it conjures up in you. You know, if it's like the neat aspect of it, if you boil it all down and you take all the bells and whistles off and you just boil it down to just the feeling part of the equation, if you like, it's how much of that there is in the song. And that, for me, was the deciding factor on whether a song stayed or went. There's some really good songs that didn't make it onto the album. And it's because that amount of that feeling wasn't in there, you know.
I know you would have been asked this a lot in the past about kind of who influenced you as a songwriter, but there's a very specific thing I want to, that I picked up when I was kind of, I know these songs inside out, and I was kind of analysing some of them the other day. And I noticed there's a pattern on a lot of your earlier ones that are very euphoric, that are sing-alongs, but they don't actually have a chorus. So if you look at My Weakness Is None of Your Business, you could argue maybe it has a chorus at the end, retread. It's like the chorus is just kind of you could almost class it as an outro. And also, almost you could say the Goodwill Out potentially has that as well. That's All Changed Forever. I wonder where that came from, that you can write these sing-along melodies, but you never wanted to use the traditional structure of revisiting that melody, say, three times in
the song. Yeah, on My Weakness Is None of Your Business, we worked with Youth, the producer, on the Goodwill Out near the end. And he was like, that's a really big song. That should be verse, chorus, like, what are you doing? And I don't know, but just for some reason, we just really strongly, instinctively felt like that was the wrong steer. I'm with good people, like, you know, that's verse, chorus, then a really long musical bit, then a middly bit, then a chorus, and then a long end bit. You know, it's not a traditional structure. And a lot of the record companies at that time, the ones that we didn't end up working with, were saying, we need to do an edit of this, we need to change the structure and stuff. And again, it was just really instinctive. We just sort of did what we felt the song needed to do, and then once the song had done it, get out of there, you know. And with My Weakness, it just felt right to have two verses and a chorus rather than verse, chorus, you know. You know, I was always saying, like, you know, if they want to get that feeling again, they'll stick it on again. In a way, it's like it's giving someone a five-course meal for a song. If you just give them every single thing they want, and it's going to like be like their belly's going to be full and they're going to want to go to sleep at the end of it. You know, what I prefer is like a quick shot.
So interesting how you kind of you did that. And because you're so close to the songs, because they're your, you know, everyone regards, you know, write a song, it's your baby. If you had the chance to, what percentage of your songs would you go back and edit in some way? So when you listen to them, do you ever think, ah, oh, the hi-hat's too high in that bit, or I wish I'd changed this a little bit, or are you quite happy for it to be out there? When you listen back to your old stuff?
Yeah. I mean, we are much better now as a band than we were when we recorded The Goodwill Out. And I think that the choices that we would make now are almost going to be better on pretty much any album that we've recorded, you know, in the past, because we're so much better now. You know, we're better as a band. I'm a better singer. And so, ironically, that's what we're, in between writing new albums, that's what we're doing. We're actually doing a version of our biggest songs. We're doing new versions of them. So, yeah, that's maybe next year.
Amazing.
That's going to happen. But yeah, we've already done Fireworks, My Weakness Is None of Your Business, and All You Good Good People re-recorded. And they all sound better than they've ever sounded, I think. We're already halfway through working on the next album, Album 10, believe it or not.
Amazing.
Well, just because, like, as I said to you, like, at the end of the last session on the last album, we wrote three of the biggest songs, and we wanted to keep going while the iron was hot, and so yeah, we've kept writing, and I've already got a list, and yeah, we're going to be getting together very soon to start sessions for that.
I know you get asked about your relationship with Richard probably all the time, but we have a lot of emerging musicians listening to this, right? That's like a core listenership, and there may be emerging musicians now listening to this who in bands with loved ones, like, you know, probably brothers or sisters, whatever it might be. How have you cracked compartmentalizing when your bandmate relationship ends and your brotherhood begins, so that you're not having Christmas dinner talking about, like, what song should we choose as a B-side, you know, that type of thing? So how does it not merge and blancmange into one?
It is all merged into one. Yeah. I don't compartmentalize at all. The band is such a fundamental part of my life and who I am, and for Richard as well. We just talk about it in the same breath as we talk about everything else. I mean, obviously, like, there are chats that are, you know, purely about family, you know. His daughter's doing really well at the moment. I'm always asking him what's going on there with Ella and the music and stuff. And you know, so we have, like, personal lives where we chat about personal stuff, but I don't think we compartmentalize. I certainly don't. I can't think of a time where I've said, oh, let's not talk about embracing this situation. It's inappropriate. You know, we just do it, you know. No, I mean, maybe we should, you know. I mean, we don't really want to talk. So, for instance, if we're in a bigger family setting, the rest of the family would probably want to hear how things are going with embrace more than we want to talk about it, because we've talked about it a lot.
Yeah.
So it's kind of the opposite. It's not like we're bringing embrace up to talk about it in inappropriate situations. It's that the family want to know whatever news we've got, and we're like, we're over it. We want to relax, you know?
Hey, welcome. Hi, everyone. It's Darcy again. I'm just interrupting the episode briefly to let you know that our merch line is available right now. We have hoodies, mugs, notebooks, tote bags, stickers, t-shirts, anything you can imagine online right now to help you support the podcast. So head to the-stageleft-podcast.printify.me to go grab yourself some lovely Stage Left merch and help us support the podcast so that we can keep producing free and educational content for you all. I won't keep you too long, so let's get back to the episode.
So let's talk about, so the standout track for me on three listens this morning was Get Out of My Own Way. And so I think you said Mickey Dale brought that original chord progression in there. Tell us your memories of piecing that together, because that felt like peak embrace. That just felt like a friend of mine who actually you spoke to on the phone just before headlining V Festival back in the day. He messaged me and he just went, what a fucking great song this morning in relation to that. So what are your memories of piecing that one together?
Yeah, I'm really happy with that one. I think you're right. I think it's up there with the best ballads that we've done. I think, you know, for instance, if I'd just written That's All Changed or My Weakness or Fireworks or Drawn From Memory now and Get Out Of My Own Way was on one of the first two albums, people would be saying the opposite. You know, they'd be saying, oh, Fireworks is as good as Get Out Of My Own Way. You know, it's just...
I hear that.
I think you can't take away from history and sentiment and memory. You know, those songs that first hit people, you know, when they were in their 20s, you know, if you broke up with someone in your 20s and Fireworks was the soundtrack to that, some song that you're hearing now in your mid to late 40s, it's probably not going to have the impact that Fireworks had back then. And so I can't compete with that. I can only write the best stuff I can write, you know. But I, as a songwriter, I feel like it's up there with the best ballads that I've ever written. Mickey Dale brought the piano and the chords. And I just got this melody that I really liked. It was right at the end of the session. Richard was saying he wasn't happy that the album was finished yet. He said it needed something. He brought Coming Home, which I think is up there as well.
There's another really good one, yeah.
Yeah, and I, me and Mick brought Get Out Of My Own Way. And Get Out Of My Own Way is just, it's a really confessional. Someone was asking me, which songs are sort of the most intense or difficult in a way to write, and I said the confessional ones, the sort of mea culpa ones, the ones where I'm the baddie, and I've written quite a few of them, you know. I'll admit, you know, no one's perfect. I'm certainly not. The important thing is to grow and move on, you know, if you've done something bad or you've had a bad philosophy or whatever it is. With Get Out Of My Own Way, there's a line in there where I say, joy lights up your face, I look the other way. Everything you gave, I gave it all away. And that's this idea that, like, me and my wife have got two small children, and quite often she'd be living in the moment, that thing we talked about earlier on, with our two children in the room. And she'd look over at me because they'd just done something really cute or something, you know, developmental stage that was really beautiful or whatever. And I'm in the corner working, you know. I'm like either writing an embrace song or writing script or, you know, working on something. And so I wasn't paying attention. And all these wonderful moments were happening in my life and I wasn't seeing it, you know. So it's like That's really bad.
So with that in mind, so I've got a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old, and we recently asked my 5-year-old, what is daddy good at? And her response was working. And it was like, fuck, right? Okay. That's a bit of a red flag, right?
Yeah.
When it comes to your kids and to your 4-year-old knowing what you do, are you someone who'd encourage someone to go into the arts at all? Like you talk about script writing as well. Or is there any part of you which is like, it's a bloody hard industry that, and I'm not sure it's the best thing for my kids? Because even you're going to have that dad head on of wanting to protect them, look after them. What's your views on that?
The big piece of advice on that is enjoy the journey and don't always think about the destination. When we started out, we were very much thinking about as soon as we get to the top of this mountain, where's the next mountain? You know, just constantly on the, you know, trying to achieve. And at no point really did we ever stop and look at the view or smell the flowers or do any of that stuff. And that's a real shame, because there's really no point in having any sort of high achievement unless you live, unless your moment changes, because you don't live in the past. You don't live in the future. All you've got is now, literally. And if you're not engaged with what's happening in the now, you're not really living anymore. And, you know, and I can say that for the first, God knows how many years, it's only very recently I've realized this, I wasn't living in the now at all, you know, wasn't in the moment. And so I would advise any artist, any creative is to, yeah, sure, you know, being creative can be quite an internal experience. It can also be quite isolating. You do a lot of it on your own. But you have to live as well. You have to enjoy the journey. And if you're not enjoying the journey, the destination really doesn't make up for it. It really doesn't. Like, we've had like 3 number one albums. We've had what most people who are trying to be a band, we've had success, you know. Like, we've sold out tours and all the rest of it. The successes are not worth not enjoying the journey.
Yeah.
And so I would sort of backwards engineer that and say, before you get any success, and Nana Cherry actually said this to me before we even recorded the first album. She said, it's not about the end result. It's the journey. Enjoy the journey. If you don't enjoy the journey, you won't enjoy any of it in the end. And she said that to me. I wish I'd listened harder, because if I'd have listened 30 years ago, I'd be, you know, I'd have had these epiphanies a lot sooner. But then again, this album might not be as good, you know.
So let's fast forward 20 years, and Danny, you're lying on a hammock with a cocktail or non-alcoholic beverage, whatever it might be, and it's done. You're in your 70s, and you're like, okay, I'm not going to be doing too much more of this anymore. What do you want to look back having achieved, which you've had amazing achievements? What do you want to look back having achieved that you haven't quite got around to yet?
I want the songs. I want to be able to look back and say that the songs that we wrote were consistently good. I don't want to see like a slow ebb. And most bands, they do their best stuff on their first couple of albums, and then after that, there's like a slow fade. I don't want to see that. I want to look back and see, yeah, you know, there'll be highlights, but I want to see like high dots in each year, so that when I get to like 70 or whatever, I'm still writing good stuff. I'd like to quit when I'm still got good stuff coming. I think that's I'd only really quit if I had something better to do. So I hope if I'm quitting, it's because something else has happened that's even more exciting. Nice. I can't conceive of just wanting to lie on my ass. I can't get around my head around that. I'm too motivated to. I'm happiest doing than I am resting. I don't like resting.
Nice. Thank you for answering that, because I know it's quite a reflective, well, forward-thinking question in regards to having to think deeply about it. When my second daughter was 1 day old, I got special permission to go out and see you do the Goodwill Out in Full in Brighton. That's popular, if you imagine, decision. But we had the grandparents open and stuff like that just for a couple of hours. Would you ever consider doing Drawn from Memory in Full?
I don't know if there's the demand there for it. When we did the Goodwill Out, like, the audiences were pretty much as big as they would have been if we'd have done a new album, if not bigger. And same for Out of Nothing. I don't know if it'd be the same for Drawn from Memory. We do really love Drawn from Memory as a band, as an album. And we are actually going to be doing a couple at the Peace Hall tomorrow of Drawn from Memory, which we haven't done for a long while. So, it's not that we don't think it's worthy of celebration. It's just that it wasn't as commercially as successful an album. So in terms of doing it as a tour in its own right, I might be wrong, but I don't think that it works for the promoters, you know.
I'm just thinking about one-off gig or something like that, or pairing it with another album. Do you know, do Drawn from Memory and then do Out of Nothing or something like that? I don't know, something like that.
Yeah, I can imagine like doing like a secret gig of just Drawn from Memory. It might be really cool. I think
it's so class.
I really like that. What do you remember? That's maybe something to be thinking about.
So what do you remember of writing Liar's Tears? Actually, this is a plectrum you once gave me at the end of a gig that I kept on to for 20. You still using your Jim Dunlop 60 mils? What do you remember writing Liar's Tears? My band used to do a bit of a cover of that, and love that one. I remember when it came out, the week before it came out, Melody Maker said they'll be deciding who's the Lennon and who's the McCartney with this one. It was like, oh wow, this must be a special one. What do you remember of writing that song?
I think it was just really simple. It just came to me in sort of a wanna, really, on guitar, on acoustic. Often the best songs do. They're just, you know, like Fireworks was like that. They just come almost like, and Looking As You Are was like that. They just sort of come out in the time it takes to sing it, in a wanna, pretty much.
Nice.
I love the line, angels rush in where all those fools fear to tread, afraid they lose. I think that's a great line. It's a song I can sing a cappella as well. I've done that at a few gigs.
I do remember that. You used to do a cappella. That's right.
Which I don't, you know, I mean, that's, I'm not really technically that great as a singer, so I don't often do that, but it's just for me, it's not a standout track, really, in terms of. But then that might be because it was easy to write. And I was saying this to someone else about a song that Chris from Coldplay wrote, which he doesn't. I don't know if he really rates it because they hardly ever play it. But it's a song called "Oh," which is on the album that Magic's on. Can't remember what that album's called now, but yeah. And it's one of the most beautiful songs. I think it's like, for me, it's one of my favorites that they've ever written. But I think it's the reason that I like it is because it's very crisp. Like, I know him as a person, and it sort of feels like an undiluted piece of his soul. You know, it's just that's who he is. That song is who he is. And maybe he doesn't love it because it's so, he can't see it from another person's point of view. So it's not that impressive to him. It's just more of what he does, you know. So maybe that's the same with Liar's Tears. It's like, it's kind of an easy song for me to do, that kind of song. And so maybe I don't value it as much as I should.
Interesting. One of the things I was interested that you get involved with is you do these songwriting camps, right? Well, I think you have been, or you'd be going to do that. What's the experience for someone going along to that? Do you ever?
That was amazing. I absolutely love doing that. Yeah, I did it a few weeks ago. I'd definitely advise anybody who is a songwriter to go along to that. It's done with Kyle from The View.
That's right.
Who's an incredible songwriter and an extremely underrated singer. His voice is Have you heard his cover of River Deep Mountain High?
No, I've not.
But we'll God. Yeah, I mean, it's just breathtaking. I mean, in The View, you can tell he's a good singer, but the songs don't really demand much of him. They're kind of indie, you know. But he has some pipes on him. My God.
So what's the experience at the camp? So if someone turns up, what do they experience? Is it, do you play?
Yeah, so you go there and there's this huge like villa that's got, I don't know, like sort of 20 bedrooms in it, and separate bathrooms and all that. And it's got a studio, like a swimming pool, gym, gymnasium. It's like this incredible retreat, really. In the middle of Spain, southern Spain, and you go out there, and there'll be like, so in the week I went, it was me and Kyle, and there was like, I think it was like, there's usually around about 20 people there. 20 people come out on these retreats, and then you have a set amount of time with me, where I will go through, you know, what is it you want to learn? Where are you at on your musical journey? Is usually the sort of cheesy question I ask at the beginning, you know, like what do you want from this? You know, do you want help working on a song you've already written? Do you want to start one from scratch? Do you want help with lyrics? Do you want to know any questions about the business, or just, you know, just generally be available for a couple of hours? And then they'll then go and do workshops with other people, other producers and other people at the camp. They'll then record some songs. They'll then do some stuff with Kyle as well. And then at the end of the week, you get back together again and see what progress you've made and chat through and stuff. And from my point of view, I went out there. The first session was at 11. And I did sort of 11 till sort of 5 every day, like 3 2-hour sessions. And then at night, everyone just sort of gathers around and jams and plays like covers or plays new songs that they've been writing and stuff. And there's a really strong sense of like camaraderie there. Nice. And a real sort of sense that everyone had everybody else's back. You know, and everybody, you know, so just making those connections, I think, is a valuable thing. But I certainly co-wrote a couple of really good songs while I was there.
Did you?
Yeah. And one ended up being a proposal song for this guy who was going to propose to his wife.
Nice.
And another one ended up being with this artist who was like, you know, I just really loved the song and wanted to record it and was like, you know, this is... And then you know, we did some good work. I think, you know, songwriting is a hit and miss game, and I will always write a good song. Like, I can just sit down and write a good song now, but writing special ones, well, I mean, they're special, they're hard, they're few and far between. But I think in that week we got a couple of special moments, so that's pretty good. That's pretty good hit rate.
What advice would you give to emerging musicians who are writers or artists who tread the line between external versus internal validation? And you would have, through your career, I'm sure, kind of been either side of that tightrope. And what I mean by that is, you know, how do you avoid... It's interesting you said, oh, okay, we released the album this morning, I've gone online and generally the feedback is pretty good. How do you avoid not getting kind of sucked into the world of only external validation, which is... knowing if something is good purely because someone else tells you it, as opposed to you know.
Like I knew before anybody said anything.
Yeah, good.
I mean, I was in no doubt at all.
Yeah, good.
Like I my yardstick is the only thing I use, really. It's nice that other people get something from it, and I'm not going to detract from that, but what I think of something is not dependent on it, even 1%.
Last question then. If you could be president of the music industry for one day, what law would you change, or what rule would you bring in?
I'd make PRS immediately accountable. I'd use a computer program instead of people, and I would make it so that every musician got exactly what they were worth, and all the people who've inserted themselves in the middle and are making millions would be taken out
Great answer.
Maybe not hung. Taken out and told to find a different job.
Very good.
There's no reason for PRS now. It can all be done on AI.
Yeah.
And there's millions going to other people to maintain PRS as its own thing that should be going into the pockets of struggling musicians. And the second thing I would do is I would ban people like Daniel Ek and their ilk.
Yeah.
Making money from streaming. I would bring it back to the musicians. I'd make it so that it was more democratic, and the revenue that was actually spent on music went to the pockets of the musicians and not the hedge fund gangsters and tech moguls who already have way too much money. And if you got me started on this, we could have a 5-day long chat about this.
Like, yeah.
There is so much injustice on that side of things. It's just evil and wrong.
Listen, we're gonna wrap up there because I know you've got another interview to get to. But I just want to say, honestly, such a privilege to have you on the podcast. I've been been listening to your band and turning up at gigs for coming into three decades now. And keep up the great work. Really excited about your new album. You've got a tour coming up. Do you want to tell us roughly about the tour coming up?
Yeah. So this year is like busiest year that I've had since the busiest day I ever had was the World Cup song. That was insane when we announced that. But other than that, this year, we've got the Outstars that we've just done, then the Peace Hall gig, then the festivals, then the book, then the booked tour, then the proper band tour, and that's in November. And it feels like there's a bit of a renaissance around Embrace because all the venues are selling faster than they ever have. Yeah.
Right.
Well, not than they ever have, but than they have for like a long while, maybe over a decade. So it feels like we've sort of turned a corner and things are growing again. I mean, they've always been good, but, we're just sort of playing bigger venues, selling them out quicker. It's amazing that after 30 years, we're still, feels like a growing and going and growing concern, which is amazing and a massive privilege for me, a real, I couldn't be happier.
There you go. You got that island. So embrace.co.uk is where you'll be able to find out everything to do with the band and the tours and the book talks and that type of stuff as well.
Yeah. Right? I think I just use Google. Like I'm not all that joined up. Like just if you want to find out about the book tour, just put Danny McNamara speaking tour. If you want to find out about the album, just put Embrace album and you will find a link.
Good advice. Well, listen, thanks for your wisdom and your advice and good luck on with the upcoming tour. Well done on getting this album out. It's great stuff. And thanks for being such a great guest on the Stage Left podcast.
Oh, my pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the episode. But just before you go, I want to drop in again and say that our brand new merch line is available right now. So head to the-stageleft-podcast.printify.me to check out all our new hoodies, t-shirts, mugs, stickers, tote bags, notebooks to help support the podcast. If you could go over there and check that out and maybe purchase something, it's an amazing way to help support us and keep us going so that we can produce free and educational content for y'all about the music industry, which really helps a lot of young musicians and people looking to get into the industry. All of the merch is great. I love it. I have the hoodie here and I've also got one of our notebooks. And it's just a great way of helping support us and keep us going as well. So I'd be greatly appreciated if you could head over to the-stageleft-podcast.printify.me and have a little look at all of our merch. It would be so, so, so appreciated. So I hope you enjoyed the episode there and go check out our brand new merch. Thank you for watching.